Shrink Wrap Radio number 358, A Soul-Centered Approach to Creativity with Dr. Jonathan Katz.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Jonathan Katz, and we'll be discussing how he brings everything from the Chinese martial arts to Jungian psychology, transpersonal psychology, Rogerian psychotherapy, and more to bear on creativity. Jonathan Katz, PhD, is a Chicago-based clinical psychologist who specializes in working from a mind-body approach in combination with Jungian/archetypal and transpersonal psychology. For over 20 years, he's been a student and teacher of traditional Chinese martial arts, meditation, and qigong, an inner-door student of Sifu Wu Qing, practicing the White Crane system, which has its origins in the Buddhist monastic traditions of China and Tibet. In addition, he's been a musician, both performing and recording, an actor, director, producer, and writer. John specializes in working with creative artists to help enhance creativity and performance, and with anyone who wants to bring more creativity and meaning into their lives and work. He is a therapist with the Jung Center in Evanston, Illinois, and gives workshops and classes in A Soul-Centered Approach to Creativity, which incorporates an embodied multi-arts approach. In addition, he gives workshops on qigong and psychotherapy, integrating Eastern meditative and energy practices with Western psychotherapy. He's currently at work on a book about his approach to creativity. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Jonathan Katz, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, thank you.
You and I have a friend in common, namely Dr. Ron Alexander.
Yeah, he's a wonderful man that I've been doing some consulting with. He's been consulting me in my practice, and we've just been talking back and forth about some of the various mind-body approaches that he uses and that I use, and thought it might be a good idea for you and I to speak.
Yeah, well, that's great. I appreciate him referring you to me. It was a good referral as I looked at your background, and Ron and I have known each other for a long time, ever since he was a master's student, and I was a young faculty person in the program that he was in. And then we managed to maintain our friendship over the years, and I actually got to do some workshops with him as well in recent years. Yeah, well, what an interesting background you have. A longtime Kung Fu and Qigong practitioner, musician, actor, director, producer, writer, Jungian/Rogerian/transpersonal therapist, and creativity workshop leader. I hardly know where to start.
Wow, when you put it all out there like that, are you talking about me? But I suppose you are, yeah.
Yeah, so which of these came first? Maybe you should just take us through the various stages of your development to tell us how you arrived at where you are today. So take us through all those.
Sure. I guess how far do you want to go back?
Oh, wherever it needs to start. We've got plenty of time.
Well, what immediately jumped to mind when you said that was me in about probably fourth grade in Mr. Henderson's class in West Bloomfield, Michigan. And they had a program where various kids' fathers would come and speak about what they did for a living. And we'd take turns going because the whole class couldn't go. And I had found out that there was a psychologist coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even sure if I knew what a psychologist was at that point.
Yeah, really? I wouldn't have.
But I knew for some reason I had to go. As it turned out, there was some mix-up and some other kids got to go, and I was very upset. The teacher saw it, and finally he just said, John, go. I'm not quite sure what that all means, but I guess at a very early age somehow I was drawn to this stuff. So that's what came to mind. The next step, I guess, would be just starting in school, playing music, playing piano, playing in band, which took me through to sort of the kind of teenage person into the world of rock and punk rock and playing that sort of music and starting to move up in that scene in the Detroit area, which is a whole other interesting story, which maybe we'll get to. From there, I went to theater and began studying martial arts and meditation and Qigong concurrently with that.
Now, you're about how old at that point?
Started doing that at about the age of 18, 19. Once stopped doing music, had an urge to keep performing and explore that, and started doing some acting, moved more into the directing part of things, some writing. After that, moved to Boston, got more into doing film and film production and doing some more writing. Eventually, circling back to psychology, I had worked in the psychiatric units off and on throughout the years, along with having, of course, my own therapeutic journey. And then, so coming back here to Chicago, well, not back, moving to Chicago, going to grad school here to become a clinical psychologist.
Oh, where did you go to school?
The Illinois School of Professional Psychology.
Okay, and were you a psych major as an undergraduate?
I was not. I was a theater major.
Okay, good.
Bachelor of Fine Arts in Theater, yeah.
Sure, that's a good background.
So very varied and eclectic, but it all seems to intersect somehow, at least for me.
How is it that all these experiences feed into your work on creativity?
Well, of course, directly the creative experiences feed into that. In terms of martial arts, well, it says right in the name, martial art. It is an art, and I sort of define art as anything that you dedicate at least a good part of your life to, that transforms yourself in the process as well as transforming the medium you're working on. So the painting, the piece of music, your body, whatever it might be. A matter of dedicating yourself to that, to the perfection or increasing the quality of that, and not only in terms of expression, but in terms of communication.
You also talk about that you see creativity as a whole body experience. What do you mean by that? And maybe you can give us an example.
Sure. You can look at it from a variety of ways, from the sort of macro level down to the individual level. On a macro level, if you look at sort of traditional cultures from way back when, you know, if you look at sort of the shamanic practices and ritual and dance, they all sort of feed into each other. Somebody might go out, cry for a vision in a vision quest, receive that vision, come back to the village or wherever it might be, enact that physically. There might be some words or song that accompany that. So that's sort of a broad way of looking at it. On a more personal level, there's sort of a way that we experience the world. It can be on this continuum, anywhere from kind of physiological processes that we're not aware of or barely aware of, like our heartbeat, our blood pressure, and so on, and then maybe some physical things that we are aware of, maybe a pain, an ache, a rapid pulse, through some sort of a vague sort of sense, something like, there's something going on here in me, but I'm not quite sure what. And then moving all the way to the other end of the continuum about, oh, I know this is about X because of Y, and so I'm going to do Z. To me, the most powerful wellspring of creativity is that middle part, that part of, I'm not exactly sure what's going on, but there's something in there. There might be a tension in my chest. I'm not sure what it is. By the way, some of this comes out of focusing. You may be familiar with Eugene Genlin.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. And so to me, that sort of undifferentiated, unexpressed, sort of vague felt sense, as he would call it, is a place of great creativity. So second part of your question, an example of this. So say in a workshop, I might have participants go into a meditative state and maybe ask themselves, what is this all about for you? What is this workshop about for you? What is this project? Whatever it might be that they're sort of holding in their attention. And to see, quote unquote, where that sort of lives in your body. It might feel like a tension in your chest or a heaviness or jitteriness in your belly or whatever it might be. And then through sort of a recursive process of getting in touch with those places and in some cases entering into those places, so to speak, an image might emerge or a feeling or some words or a phrase. From that sort of felt sense, that can be a springboard to a project, to an approach, to a solution to an issue. It's amazing what can come out of something like that.
I gather you see creativity as a whole body experience, and I guess that's what you've kind of been talking about. Say a little bit more about the whole body experience and how that feeds into creativity. And I'm wondering, who takes these workshops? Are these people all musicians, or do they come from a variety of fields? You know, what is it that they're reaching for?
Sure. Well, I'll start with your first question. So in terms of a whole-bodied approach to creativity, well, I'll give you an example. Maybe that will illustrate it more. So I was talking about maybe coming up with an image from the focusing, and that's a sort of a bodily felt sense to begin with. From there, I might ask the participants to get up and move that image, so to speak. So say they've got an image of a burning sun in their chest. I might have them express that in movement through, could be through a posture, through dance, through whatever it might be, and then explore that movement. Make it as big as you can. Make it as small as you can. Having other people reflect it so you can see what that movement looks like. From that, to me again, you're accessing that sort of middle ground of the undifferentiated felt sense, the place of power to me in creativity. Again, coming from the martial arts background and my background in theater, this was very often a place where you're not just sort of working creativity through your mind, coming up with kind of intellectual solutions. It's coming organically out of the organism.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of getting the feel for that now.
Yeah. From that movement, then, you can move to written word or verbal processing or drawing or painting. And the process I use, which kind of goes again back to that shamanic process, it's sort of a recursive process where you're sort of cycling through the various ways of expression and processing. So it might be meditation, focusing through movement, through drawing, and then verbal processing, and then back to drawing, or possibly playing instruments, whatever the sort of makeup of the group might be and their intention.
How has this worked in your own personal life? Can you think of some creative insights or breakthroughs that have made a difference in your life?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I was going through a time where I felt my creativity was shut down. And various reasons, I just felt like the creative part of myself was sick or wounded or not functioning on all cylinders, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So through this process, and this was in the context of a workshop, this was sort of co-facilitated participant. We were all kind of leading, participating in this sort of workshop. And by the way, this stuff does tend to work much better in an intentional community of people, in a dedicated space, et cetera, and it's dedicated time. So within that, began to meditate, coming up with various images. What specifically came up in the drawings I was drawing was this image of my legs. For some reason, my legs kept coming up, and the image of like very sort of injured legs, like with barbed wire and all this bizarre kind of the image. I remember a phrase that came up was Holocaust legs. I have no idea what that even meant, but something about my legs. So, of course, the step after that, we began to move it and began to sense that my legs under me were not so strong. They were injured, in a sense, feeling ungrounded, feeling unable to move, in a sense. So from there, doing some writing and more movement and more drawing, came to a point of there is something in the process, and this is derived from the work of Anna Halperin. I'm not sure if you're aware of her.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, so she's an amazing, what she calls life art. She draws no distinction between life and art. But she has this notion of scoring a piece in which sort of at the end of one of these explorative workshops, you might kind of put together some of the ideas involving other people in the group and sort of ask them to participate in a dance or a drama or some ritual that comes to you throughout the process.
And she comes out of the dance world, right?
She does, very much so. And I trace her even further back to, I don't know if she's consciously doing this or unintentionally, but all the way back to sort of ritual, which I know she does a lot of kind of intentional ritual. Mm-hmm. She had healed, I think it was Mount Shasta or one of the mountains out in California because some murders had taken place there. So she organized this big ritual to kind of heal the mountain. So she's very in tune with this stuff. In any event, I did this scoring, and I had the women in the group. For some reason, it came out that it needed some healing by women. the sort of archetype of wise old women or kind of a kindly witch, so to speak. I had scored this sort of healing ritual for my creativity, for my legs, for me. So went through that, wasn't sure what was going to happen, didn't know if it meant anything. But after that workshop, just a stream of poems started to emerge. I was back in Chicago and wasn't even sure what was going on, but sort of downloading these poems from myself, capital S, or the universe, or whatever you want to call it. So that's just one example. And there are many that I've had or participants in the workshop have had.
Well, that's a great example. I like that story. And if any other stories occur to you during our conversation, be sure to throw them in, because you know how we are also tuned in and responsive to story.
Well, another one comes to mind if you
want
to hear.
Okay, yeah, go for it.
Okay, and this sort of speaks to, I guess, how, you know, the other part of what I do, the Qigong and martial arts and meditation, kind of can dovetail and interact with the creative process. So was doing a workshop, and this workshop was, as luck would have it, or fate, all women, a group of women. And as often happens in these workshops, a sort of general theme emerges. It might be transformation. It might be new growth. It might be, well, in this case, it happened to be grief. Just about all the participants were dealing with some form of grief or another. Now, I am Rogerian person-centered, so I tend to be pretty gentle about directiveness in the workshops. I let them sort of take their own course, or I might make suggestions or offer a menu, but let them decide. And the folks in this workshop were aware that I did the Qigong and whatnot, and they asked if I could show them some. So I said, why not? And in kind of traditional Qigong, traditional Chinese medicine, there are various animal archetypes that kind of embody a certain feeling or emotion or even time of year, etc. Generally, there are like five basic animals. They vary through the systems. The system I do actually has 10 animals. But so I took them through basic animal movements and that kind of thing.
Well, what are the animals? What are the five traditional and the 10 in your system?
Sure. Well, the ones I did in the workshop were crane, tiger, deer, bear. Let's see, what am I missing here?
Would each of these tend to bring out a certain quality, or how would you describe what these do?
The one that kind of came out in this workshop was tiger. And tiger is associated with the element of metal and the time of year of the fall, autumn, and the emotion of grief. And so if you think about the fall, when leaves are falling off the tree and we're starting to move into winter, it's about letting go. Now, the other part of it, if you think of the movements of a tiger or the element of metal, like a sword slashing through or tiger claws tearing through or ripping through, it's sort of a different way of dealing with grief. Now, we tend to more passively deal with grief, crying, letting go, this sort of thing, which, of course, is all valuable. But this sort of approach is a much more active, proactive way of letting go. If you think of, again, the motions, the movements of a tiger tearing through something, or the sword or axe chopping through something as a means to letting go. So lo and behold, no surprise, the women in the group dealing with grief really resonated these movements. So they found some power in the grief and in the letting go. Many of them drew after this pictures of tigers. I remember one woman saying she even, you know, and it turned out she didn't know this, but she was actually a very gifted visual artist. And this often happens in the groups. People discover new talents they didn't know they had. But she, this very beautiful, detailed picture of a tiger, she keeps it on her dresser to this day and just looks at it and finds it so empowering for her. She was a person that had taken a very passive stance in life and was dealing with a lot of grief. And last time I checked with her, she was taking a very active stance in life and kind of doing that, again, that tearing through and moving forward.
You've actually touched on a bunch of things that I wanted to ask you about. I know you use the term multi-arts, and I think that we're beginning to get a feel for what you mean by that. Is there anything more that you'd like to say about it?
Just that the art itself can be anything. So, for instance, in one workshop, I had a very gifted flamenco guitarist. And I always invite people, if they are musicians, even if they're not, to bring their instruments. So in that case, incorporated into this process of writing verbal movement, he and others could bring in a drum and play it or play guitar alongside these other activities.
Now, you mentioned utilizing Qigong in the service of creativity. Is there another example of that?
Sure. And this kind of goes to then how I use the creativity perhaps in sessions with people. Oh, by the way, just thought of the other animal, monkey. And monkey is associated with the element of earth, and that's in Chinese thought, there's five seasons, and that's sort of the late summer, early fall season, and that goes along with the emotion of worry or insecurity, that sort of thing.
Okay.
So in terms of Qigong creativity, one of the things I have my clients do, their game in session, is to begin to explore, again, they might go into meditation or focusing and come up with some images to work with. Now, one of the ways we can work with that is instead of just sort of letting the movements just sort of express themselves naturally, which is great, and that's my first course of action generally, but given my background and training in the Qigong and martial arts, inevitably these movements either directly or very closely mimic or imitate movements that are inherent in the Qigong postures or the system I do. And if you think about it, Qigong is basically all derived from natural movements or movements of animals or just sort of everyday movements of people. So I might have them begin to move an idea, an image, a sensation. And from there, I might see what sort of Qigong movement it's approximating. And so I might tweak it a bit or just invite them to explore that if they want. If that holds more power for them in some way, whether just through the movement itself or the fact that it's sort of imposing some sort of ritual to it, we'll go with that. If not, we'll go just with their movement.
So in other words, you have them start with a spontaneous movement, mm-hmm. and then you kind of, if you sense that, oh, this is kind of like monkey, then you sort of move them in that direction if it fits for them.
Exactly. And it might be an animal movement. It might just be a different sort of movement from one of the postures or forms that we do, et cetera.
Yeah. In some ways, the roots of Qigong and the various martial arts, I'm getting the sense that maybe they tie in or are related to Jungian ideas about archetypes and myth and the Jungian approach. How does that fit in for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, depending on what level you want to look at it, in a very basic level, this tradition, these movements, this philosophy comes right out of sort of the traditional folk religions and spiritual traditions of the various places these art forms came from. The system I do came concurrently from China and Tibet, through sort of a monastic, Buddhist monastic tradition. Mm-hmm. But it also, the roots go even further back before that to the Taoist and just indigenous sort of folk traditions from these various regions. So that in and of itself is sort of a ritual space, a ritual energy. Then moving to some of the forms themselves, generally, at least in our system, in many traditional systems of martial arts and Qigong. So there's a form I do called Guanggong Zhang Choyong, which means Guanggong, who's a famous general archetypal historical figure in Chinese history, chops Choyong. And it uses one of these huge kind of pike sword staffs. I don't know if you've seen it. It's got like a big curved blade and a point on the end.
Yes, I've seen those.
Yeah. So in any event, the form reenacts a famous battle between Guanggong and Choyong. It's storytelling, it's ritual, it's myth through this form. And the battle not only probably was historical in a sense, who knows, but the idea in that battle, the opponent that we're facing, Choyong, he has the unique property of when you try to cut his head off, there's a cord that remains attached and the head keeps coming back on. You can't chop it off. Till finally, with great effort and a kick and a scream, you chop through that cord, I guess getting back to that image of chopping through and letting go, take his head, throw it in the imaginary bag you've got over your shoulder, and move on with the form and ride your horse away. So it's telling a story, but for me, it's also a very powerful practice, especially when I'm feeling the need to access some of that kind of primal male yang as opposed to yin energy and cut through something that might be stuck and just kind of blow it out and move forward in life. So that's another way to get in touch with those sort of archetypal ritual characteristics. And then, of course, like we were discussing, just the animal movements themselves. And they're not just animal movements. They're also movements where you're imitating a Buddha or various things like that. They all have their own unique energies and archetypal spiritual connotations.
I really have a sense of that. I remember once years ago when I used to practice yoga pretty regularly. Once I was doing, I forget what the position is called, but it was kind of a shoulder stand and dropping your toes back behind your head. And I had an intense image of three sort of like red laser light point. It felt like I had tapped into the archetypal triangle.
Wow.
I only had that experience once, but it was very powerful, and it gave me a sense of, oh, this must be what these positions are about, that if I were really advanced, if I really got into this, I would have that kind of experience of the energetic shape that drove each posture.
Right. And as you just described, many of these postures have those sorts of energies inherent in them. And in a traditional sense, when you are training, when you are kind of really connected to this, doing well, having what they call gung or kung. It's the kung from kung fu or the gung in qigong.
Yeah, what is qi and what is gung?
Qi is just kind of the universal life force energy. That's just a broad term for that. You know, everything has qi. We do. The air has qi, trees, mountains. And there are various kinds of qi that they break down in some systems. But for the most part, qi, energy. And gong is, it's a word that's hard to translate into English. My best approximation of it is a deep and intensive work or practice, art, if you will. Again, that in the doing transforms yourself and transforms the thing being worked on. And it's something that's done over time. So say you have a craftsman who's been making these amazing shaker chairs for 20, 30 years. You might be saying he has chair gung. It's just so much a part of him, and he can just express it. There's no difference between himself and the chair, so to speak, or the process of making it. So that notion of gung is sort of, I think, what you were describing, where you're really connecting to not only the postural element, but really the energetic. You're really connected to it. So when we're doing kung fu at a higher level, it feels, and I think dancers and a lot of artists explain it this way, at that point, it doesn't feel like you're doing the kung fu. It feels like the kung fu is sort of doing you. And these sort of energies, the archetypal energies, are flowing through you. You're one with them, riding the wave, so to speak, but kind of are the wave at that point.
Now, you do private practice psychotherapy, is that right?
I do, yes.
It sounds like you have an interesting approach, and somebody who comes to you might be surprised, not knowing what to expect. So I'm wondering if the people who come to see you, do they know what to expect? Have they heard about your way of working, and that's why they come to see you? Or do you have a mix of both? How does this stuff integrate into what for somebody else might be a traditional practice?
Sure. And that's something I sort of wrestle with, because
I can imagine.
We all have to make a living, and, you know, we get the run-of-the-mill sort of, not that there's anything wrong with that, but just, you know, clients that generally just want to sort of talk therapy or that sort of thing, which I'm happy to do. But there is a good number that come. They're aware of what I do, whether through a posting online or whatnot, or word of mouth. And these folks might be more creative types or more spiritual types, or just folks that are interested. Other therapists a lot come and they want to learn about this approach. And then again, you know, being pretty person-centered, I might offer as much or as little as they want to do in terms of qigong meditation and stuff. It might be as simple as just doing a little bit of meditation. or it could be as elaborate as teaching them a whole form and discussing the sorts of emotions and stuff that come out of doing that form. In terms of the creative stuff, and of course it can blend, but again, it could be something as simple as having them keep a journal to, again, using these sorts of techniques within the office, having them draw, move, write. And I've done a lot of research as well into what makes creativity work just on a theoretical level, and we can talk about that. Sort of a variety of options and where they want to go with it, kind of follow that.
Well, you sort of mentioned creativity in the same breath that we're talking about psychotherapy. So I'm wondering if there is a tie-in for you between creativity and psychopathology, dealing with symptoms, healing, cure. Where does creativity come into that?
We all know there are various expressive art therapies and movement therapies and music therapy. So that's sort of spoken to already. That's already out there. And that's, of course, a very powerful way of healing. One way I look at it is, again, through sort of the lens of a more traditional ritual approach, which is a lot of these original ceremonies, vision quests, creative sort of spontaneous expressions came out of a need for some sort of guidance or healing. And even to the extent, I believe, that the sort of community rituals that were done, the storytelling, the dancing, the chanting, the retelling of a famous battle over and over, or some creation myth, to me, these all have the ability to not only heal the individual, but heal the community. Especially lately, I've been thinking a lot about it in terms of healing trauma.
Let me direct you to the work of Dr. Edward Tick, somebody that I interviewed sometime way back when, and you might find that interview on Shrink Wrap Radio or on my other series, Wise Counsel podcast. I'm not sure which series it was in. He works with returning veterans, and he draws a lot on Native American rituals and feels that there's a kind of healing of soul that has to take place. I think that really fits with what you're saying. And also, listening to you kind of reminds me of something I used to think about and really kind of forgotten about. We know that Freud felt that blocked sexual energy, if you will, led to various kinds of pathological manifestations in the personality. And it occurred to me that blocked creative energy is also a source of pathology, and maybe one that hasn't really been explored sufficiently. So many of us in our culture tend to say, oh, well, I'm not creative, I'm not an artist, I can't paint, I can't carry a tune, etc. And I may be just be projecting from my own self that there is this longing for self-expression.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, especially for a person who identifies themselves as a creative or an artist or, you know, even a dabbler, to me, the extent that your creativity is blocked, your lifeblood is blocked. The very, like you're saying, the psychic energy, the libido, whatever you want to call it, is blocked. Kind of speaking to your question before about how open people are, I have yet to find a person, once we start to work, whether it's just talk therapy or obviously through these sorts of forms, that isn't creative in some way. It could be creative in their work. It could be creative, you know, in their quilting. It could be creative directly in their art. I think this is just a natural part of who we are. I think, though, it can be especially painful for folks who've had some sort of what I call artistic trauma that, unfortunately, a lot of art schools, film schools, theater schools, dance schools inflict upon, you know, young budding creatives that kind of cut them down in their prime, so to speak. So, yeah, I agree. I think it's just a vital part of all of us that longs to seek kind of actualization.
I think that's a really interesting stone that you've turned over of creative trauma, of people who have been traumatized as a result of the way their skills or art has been received. And I'm thinking of American Idol as one contemporary example.
Sure. It's interesting. There's a great creativity writer, Teresa, I believe it's pronounced Amabile, or I'm not exactly sure. She's now, I believe, at Harvard Business School, but she's done a lot of research in creativity, and she came up with what she calls the five creativity killers. I'll list them: expectation of reward, expectation of evaluation, competition, time limits, and scrutiny. So does that sound familiar in regards to school or art school?
Oh, definitely.
Show business? Yeah. So unfortunately, the system itself is set up to kind of kill creativity. In the workshops I do, in the sessions I do, I try to provide sort of the opposite of those qualities. And Carl Rogers and the person-centered approach tend to very nicely provide an alternative to that environment of prizing and genuineness and unconditional positive regard and empathy. These tend to help creativity flourish. In the research I've done for my thesis and continue to sort of do in the workshops that I do, again and again, these qualities are listed as some of the most powerful freeing elements of the workshops, of the work.
Yeah, what was your thesis about?
It was about person-centered and experiential approaches to enhancing creativity and performance. That was the title.
So you actually were able to bring your passion that we've been discussing into the culmination of your academic work. Good for you.
Thank you. Yeah. I don't know if it was conscious or unconscious, but probably a guiding sort of light through all my work in this.
Well, speaking of that guiding light, do you have any sense of where your work might be going in the future or where you'd like to see it go?
Well, I think what's happening most recently with the work is kind of exploring and drawing upon the more, I guess you would say Jungian, but also maybe the more transpersonal, spiritual parts of things. Whether you believe or don't believe, or you consider the higher power nature or capital S self or God, whatever, to me, this has become a very powerful wellspring for people's healing, of course, and creativity, and a way that can sort of transcend a lot of the more mundane issues that people are dealing with. When they make some sort of a larger meaning of what they're doing in the world, an intention, so to speak, and how to channel sort of that life force to touch others. I have a gentleman I see, a very talented jazz saxophonist, and I don't think he would mind me bringing this up. I won't use any names, but dealt a lot with depression and worried that if he's good enough or not, et cetera, et cetera. He began to look at it as, through his horn, literally an image of channeling sort of that life force, the universal spirit, whatever you want to call it, through his horn, out touching other people's hearts. That became his sort of guiding image rather than, am I playing well or not? You know, of course, that still sneaks in, but it's more about his, I guess, in a way, spiritual mission, so to speak, or how he sees himself in the larger community of people. That becomes sort of the benchmark to gauge his, quote unquote, success, or I guess failure doesn't even apply here.
Oh, I love that. What a beautiful way to frame the act of playing the horn or playing any instrument. Well, I think we've come to a good place to wrap it up. Is there any final thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would say something I've learned from doing Kung Fu. My teacher, again, this is very much an art. My teacher, Chinese man, didn't speak any English, but very much a traditional way of teaching. And in the process of any of these endeavors, whether it's art or martial arts or doing therapy, whatnot, is this notion that this takes time. It's a long-term process. This is a lifetime of work.
Mm-hmm.
He would always sort of say in his broken English, silo, silo, which means slow. Not only doing the movement slowly, but take your time with it. This is a day-to-day lifetime practice. And sometimes you need to take breaks. Sometimes you need to work hard. That's kind of how we do it. But to really, again, develop that gung that we were talking about takes a lifetime.
Okay. Well, that's a good reminder in our fast-paced culture. It's a great reminder. So, Dr. Jonathan Katz, thanks for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dave. It's been a privilege and an honor. I'm a big fan of the show and hope I did it justice.
I think it's a very interesting synthesis that Jonathan Katz brings to his work, both as a workshop leader and as a psychotherapist. I'm guessing that there are other psychotherapists out there among our listenership who can identify with some of the elements that Jonathan has discussed here, whether they be Jungian, Rogerian, or have a background in the martial arts, have been influenced by Eugene Ginlan's focusing, a background in dance or authentic movement, and so on. For myself, I continue to find the shower the most reliable stimulant for my own creativity. In fact, I was having an email dialogue with listener Louise suggesting that she might be able to help me with my workflow for Shrink Wrap Radio. She speculated that maybe if I could get more organized, it might be less burdensome. I told her I don't see how someone from the outside would be able to help me get the shows out any more efficiently, and that my workflow pretty much requires me to do it. But then a couple of days later, I was reflecting in the shower about that exchange, and voila, I got a little flash of inspiration and realized there was a place where I could create a handy little shortcut for locating the listener emails that I want to read on the air. So thanks for that offer, Louise, and for stimulating my brain so that it could be activated by the shower. As I think about it, I think attending a workshop such as described by Jonathan could also be a great source of triggering my own creativity. I think getting away from my office and my routine, whether it be for a workshop or a vacation or a conference, helps to create the space for some new ideas to emerge from my creative unconscious, or who knows, maybe even from the collective unconscious or the higher self. If you want to find out more about Jonathan Katz and his work, particularly if you're in the Chicago area, you might go to his website, which is http://johnkatz.simdif.com. Now, John is spelled J-O-N, so it's johnkatz.simdiv.com. And I guess that might stand for similar and different. I'm not sure. But at any rate, check it out.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Josune, and I just had made a donation to your podcast, and it feels really good doing it. So it's something that I wanted to do for a long time. I have been listening to your podcast for the last couple of years. I have just graduated from clinical psychology, marriage family therapist, and while I was taking a break, I will download your podcast and go on a hike or my long commute, and I really enjoyed it. And it's been something that I really wanted to do, make a donation to as a small gesture to say thank you so much for all the good work that you do, Dr. Dave. And I wanted to encourage other listeners to do so, and so that you can keep doing what you do. So anyhow, thank you so much for the wonderful work that you do, and I encourage other listeners to do so. Thanks, Dr. Dave. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Josune, for that heartfelt endorsement. I really appreciate it. Now, I have to contrast that open-hearted and generous message from Josune with a comment that was posted in response to my interview with Danielle Shapook on episode number 356. The comment reads as follows. I'm insulting and disrespectful to us to hire someone to do a false testimonial and to get them to guilt trip us into thinking we owe you money. Now I need to step out and comment on what looks to me like a Freudian slip, because the person did write, I'm insulting and disrespectful to us. And I think they meant to say it's insulting and disrespectful to us. So I'll read it again in the way that I think they intended. It's insulting and disrespectful to us to hire someone to do a false testimonial and to get them to guilt trip us into thinking we owe you money. I thought you did this podcast because you wanted to share your love for psychology, not guilt-tripping people for money. By the way, I did sign up for your newsletter and received the first one and promptly unsubscribed when I saw it was just marketing. Soliciting us for money is not uncommon in the podcast world, but how you do it is gross. End quote. Well, I have to admit that feedback got under my skin a bit because I've always struggled with the money issue, been a little bit ambivalent about it. Of course, it's true that I do this podcast to share my love of psychology, and it's also true that I do feel I should get some monetary compensation for all the work that I put into creating these episodes. I don't think the two are necessarily exclusive, mutually exclusive, which is to say, yes, this is my passion and my gift to the world, and it would be great if listeners gave back. I sometimes wonder if having an appeal for support in each episode is too much, but then, as you will often hear in these listener endorsements, people have been listening for years until they finally feel moved to donate. So I think the repetition is helpful. And also, there are new listeners joining all the time, and I want them to know about and consider helping to support the show. Now, the last time I checked, the donations total somewhere between $300 and $400 a month. So you can see this is not a get-rich-quick scheme, and you would not believe how much time goes into creating these shows. Believe it or not, I'm usually working on shrink wrap radio several hours a day, 7 days a week. It's almost embarrassing to admit that. So yes, there is some marketing in each episode and also in the newsletter, but the newsletter is not solely marketing, as the writer stated. And of course, I do not pay people for those audio endorsements you hear at the beginning of this announcement section. I do invite people who have made donations to submit an audio clip saying why they chose to do so in hopes of inspiring others to follow suit. But I neither pay nor coerce them to submit those audio clips, and some submit them and some don't. I recently instituted that practice because I thought it would be more interesting and more compelling to hear the donation appeal from your fellow listeners. And plus, I feel awkward putting out the cup, so to speak, myself all the time. Since that comment is the only negative one I've received about my solicitations for donations, I'm going to assume that most of you are not offended in the way that this author was. So enough said about this topic. By the way, that negative comment was the only one posted in response to my interview with Danielle, Ms. Wheelchair, New York City. If anyone has something positive to say to her about the interview, it would sure be a nice counterbalance if you would post it there in the comments area. I'm happy to announce that we have a new transcript on the site, thanks to Gloria Ullman, who has transcribed number 292, The Motherline, with Jungian analyst Naomi Ruth Lewinsky, Ph.D. Thanks so much for your work on that and all the others that you've transcribed recently, Gloria. As you may know, we have an app for listening to these podcasts on Apple iOS and Android devices, and you can find out all about that by going to the Apps tab on our site. I just noticed that the player that's embedded in the app was stuck on number 251. I didn't hear from any listeners about that problem, but I do want to let you know that it's been fixed, and I plan to monitor it more often myself to make sure that it stays up to date.
Hi, this is Dr. Robert Mate, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, in response to several listener requests, Dr. Gabor Mate will be my next guest. More about that in a bit, but first let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. And first we hear from Peter B. Todd, longtime listener, supporter, and guest on episode number 240, and Peter writes, Dear David, just to inform you that I now have an ABC National Radio broadcast, and ABC, of course, stands for Australian Broadcasting Company. So he says, just to inform you that I now have an ABC National Radio broadcast featuring the content of my book, The Individuation of God, Integrating Science and Religion, which you so kindly reviewed. A podcast will also be available, and then he gives a long link, and it is on abc.net.org Todd.au. So doing a search there for Peter B. Todd, you'll find it, I'm sure. He goes on to say that the other guest on the program is Dr. Bruce Lipton, stem cell biologist and winner of the GOI Peace Prize, G-O-I Peace Prize, affiliated with UNESCO. Perhaps Dr. Lipton would be a good guest for your podcast series. Your Shrink Wrap Radio podcast is itself an outstanding contribution to the global consciousness raising about the holistic vision of the interconnectedness of all human beings. Kind regards, Peter B. Todd. So, Peter, congratulations on the continuing success of your book, the continuing attention that it's drawing. Really pleased to hear about that. And I hope some people will feel led to go listen to that podcast interview. Next, we hear from Laura, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, may I just tell you how much I love listening to your podcasts? They are fantastic, so well presented, and with great speakers and topic choices. It has really helped me a lot during my psychotherapy training. I'm in my final year, just embarking on my post-grad research project. I meant to donate something for a while, and having listened today on my usual weekly run to yet another podcast, felt guilty that it really was time. So now I have finally done it. Thank you for everything you are doing, and I really hope you continue with this terrific job and education for a long time still to come. Incidentally, I would like to ask you something. Are you familiar with Clean Language and David Groves' work? I was hoping that you might have had an interview with him, but cannot find it. He died in 2008 at age 57. He developed a unique, quotes, clean questioning, close quote, method to assist clients with traumatic memories, particularly when working with child abuse, rape, and incest, even intergenerational and ancestral healing. She goes on to say, I'm just about to embark on my postgraduate research project on, quotes, clean language, close quote, in psychotherapy. And there are some contemporary practitioners that have since expanded on this amazing work. And she cites some people, namely James Lawley, Penny Tompkins, Wendy Sullivan, Judy Reese, Philip Harland. She goes on to say, clean language is used in psychotherapy by some, but we don't know how many really are out there. It has been predominantly very successful in the coaching and business side of things. There's a lack of research in this area, and I really want to contribute to the existing knowledge in the field of client-generated metaphors and therapy for positive change. Once my research gets authorized, would you support any students that are looking to have the word spread to find some suitable therapists? My initial proposal is outlined here, and she gives the following URL, www.addsu.com. She says, would this be something you would be happy to mention? Well, I'm happy to mention it. I just have. It's an interesting site, so go ahead to that site. I'm not sure what those letters stand for, www.addsu.com, A-D-A-D-S-U.com. She says, hope you can, she provided a bunch of references for me in terms of possibly finding a guest in this area. And closes with thank you so far for everything so far. Please keep going with your amazing podcast. And that's Laura in London. She put a P.S. I am about to train with Stephen Gilligan in San Diego for 3 weeks in July and then visit friends for a week in Los Gatos end of July. Don't you live around there somewhere? Well, actually, I live several hours away, so we probably won't be getting together. But it's great to hear from you, Laura, and great to get the suggestion about the clean questioning, clean language method that I had not heard of. Of course, what it first brings to mind is dirty language, as we talk about speaking dirty. So in a way, it's kind of, I think it's kind of an unfortunate association that it brings up. But clearly, it's something I may need to look into, and I'd be interested to hear from other listeners out there, maybe who, if there's some clamoring for me to get a guest to talk about that, then I will respond to the clamoring. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on my message phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to Dr. Jonathan Katz for sharing his soul-centered approach to creativity with us today. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Gabor Mate, MD, and we'll be discussing issues surrounding substance abuse and addiction as explored in his award-winning book, In the Realm of the Hungry Ghosts. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.